Thank you, Maria Jennifer, for such a kind introduction. So, as is evident from the title of my lecture, my project at IKGF aims at constructing an intellectual genealogy of an esoteric movement in the Jesuit China mission known as Figurism that emerged in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, particularly amongst French missionaries. Today, however, I do not intend to discuss Figurism as such, but its origins in early Jesuit writings in China. As most of you are probably unaware of what Figurism is and how it is to be distinguished from earlier Jesuit interpretations of the Confucian classics, by way of introduction, I thought I'll just give you some background information on the principal characteristics of this movement before delving into the substance of my lecture. So, the undisputed pioneer of Figurism was the missionary Joachim Beauvais, who entered and born the 23rd of July, 1687, as an official scientific ambassador of Louis XIV to the Kangxi Emperor, along with four other French Jesuit missionaries. Beauvais was highly valued by the Chinese for his knowledge of European mathematics and astronomy, and after some intense training in the Manchu language, was appointed as tutor to Kangxi and later the crown prince, Yinren. Beauvais maintained a special bond with the Kangxi Emperor, even as the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Chinese court deteriorated with the Vatican's condemnation of the Jesuits' missionary methods, which the Kangxi Emperor had personally sanctioned. The approach of Beauvais and his followers towards the Chinese classics differed drastically from that of their predecessors. The most famous of the Jesuit missionaries, Matteo Ricci, proposed that the Chinese classics exhibited a primitive monotheism that was compatible with Christianity. Ricci attempted to portray Christianity not as a novel doctrine for the Chinese, but as a restoration of theological and moral principles which had been lost in China with the arrival of Buddhism and the materialism of Song Dynasty near Confucianism. Ricci was rationalist in his approach. He did not explicitly maintain that the Chinese received any special prophetic revelation or preserved in any special way the monotheistic doctrines that the Jews had inherited from Noah. Chinese monotheism was no more miraculous than Platonic or Aristotelian monotheism. According to the Thomistic principles by which Ricci was formed, natural reason was a sufficient explanation for the presence of monotheism in ancient China. Beauvais, like most of the Jesuit missionaries in China, maintained allegiance to this position, which has become known as Riccian accommodationism. But in the course of the latter half of the 17th century, Jesuit writings in China increasingly speculated on non-rational causes for Confucian monotheism. Jesuits such as Martino Martini and Philippe Couplet drew tentative links between Noah and the Chinese patriarchs, and even on occasion suggested that Chinese monotheism was a result of God's especial providential concern for the Chinese people. But Beauvais was the first to propose a comprehensive esoteric interpretation of the Chinese classics. In the most ancient of the Chinese classics, the I Ching, Beauvais saw veiled foreshadowings of Christian revelation. He scoured the hexagrams to show that the legendary creator, Fuxi, had knowledge of creation, the coming of the Messiah, and the end of the world. Although Beauvais had the greatest respect for Chinese history, he did not believe it could be interpreted literally, given the contemporaneity of China's earliest antiquity with the biblical patriarchs. Beauvais inferred that China's earliest antiquity could only be understood in relation to biblical history. Fuxi was not really a Chinese king, but the Chinese name for Enoch, the great-grandfather of Noah. Thus, the I Ching was not really a Chinese classic at all, but the lost book of Enoch. This connection with Enoch and numerology enticed Beauvais to connect the I Ching with Kabbalah, that since the Florentine Quattrocento had been used by Christian apologists to prove that Christian revelation was a fulfillment of prophecies contained in the Jews' own secret writings. Bouvet succeeded in cultivating a small coterie of French Jesuits who shared in varying ways the presuppositions of his esoteric ideas, but Figurism was never officially adopted by the French China Mission, and especially from the 1710s onwards, was actively suppressed by his Jesuit superiors. There were serious theological issues at stake. On a most fundamental level, Figurism arrived at an incredibly awkward time for the Jesuit mission. On the 26th of March 1693, the Apostolic Vicar of Fujian, Charles Mecot, condemned the Jesuit missionary project in his mandate. Mecot was primarily opposed to the continuing practice of Confucian rituals amongst Chinese Catholic converts, but touched upon the emerging Jesuit interests in the I Ching and the new Confucian Tai Chi in 6 points of the text. So Mecot writes, this is actually according to Quillani's translation, "We point out that nothing is to be published in spoken or written form which could mislead uncautious persons to error and could open the way for superstitions such as that the most wise ancient Chinese wanted to call God the cause of all things with the name Tai Chi, that the book the Chinese call the I Ching is the sum of the best physical and moral teachings. In the late 1690s and early 1700s, controversy flared over the publication of a book by Father Lecomte, Le Nouveau Mémoire sur l'état présent de la Chine. This immensely popular book was first published in 1696 and saw numerous re-editions and translations. 4 years later, it was examined by Jansen theologians at the Sorbonne. The committee condemned it as false and rash. 5 propositions within Lecomte's book that were central to the Jesuit accommodation of Confucianism. The Holy Office then started to occupy itself with the controversy and confirmed Mecot and the Sorbonne's condemnation of the decree Cum Deus Optimus in 1704 and the Apostolic Constitution Ex Illa Die in 1715. In these Roman documents, the problematics over the I Ching were a very important component. With the survival of the Jesuit mission as a whole now under threat by the changing tides in the Vatican, the Jesuit superiors wanted to present their missionary strategy in the least controversial manner possible. The esoteric interpretation of the figures not only departed from the rationalist premises of the Jesuits' original approach to the Confucian corpus, but were also an easy target for Jansenists and other enemies of the Jesuits. The superior of the French mission, François-Xavier d'Entrecolle, from 1707 to 1719, attempted to restrain Bouvet from discussing the religious contents of the I Ching with the Kangxi Emperor. In a letter dated February 13, 1711, Dr. prohibited Bouvet from making the following claims. And you see on number 4, it is possible to compute from the I Ching the future duration of the world from creation to incarnation, from incarnation to the end of times. From 1712 onwards, the Jesuit visitor in the Far East, Giampaolo Bozzani, and his successor, Gillian Stumpf, intensified the suppression of Bouvet's figurism. Bouvet became increasingly isolated amongst his Jesuit confrères and complained bitterly of the concerted persecution. To the end, he insisted that his esoteric interpretation of the Chinese classics was consistent and developed from the methods of, quote, the first famous Jesuits in China. So, as I mentioned before, tonight I do not intend to discuss Bouvet's figurism as such, but to evaluate his claimed continuity with, quote, the first famous Jesuits in China, by looking at the writings of the first Jesuit missionary in China, Michele Rogeri, and his editor, the encyclopedist, Antonio Possevino. The esoteric turn in the Jesuit interpretation of the Chinese classics has primarily been attributed to the influence of the polymath Athanasius Kircher and the revival of the ancient theology in the writings of the French priests Paul Dorière and Pierre Daniel Rouet. I do not wish to diminish the pivotal role of Bouvet's immediate intellectual context in the formation of his figurism, but re-examine the still dominant view that the early Jesuit approach towards Confucianism and other non-Christian traditions was entirely rationalistic. In fact, despite the heavy emphasis upon Thomism in the Jesuit Ratio Studiorum, there was strong esoteric undercurrent in the Jesuit literature of the late 16th century, which till now have been largely unstudied. As we shall see, these esoteric ideas also found their way in the Rogeri's discussion of China. In the late 16th and early 17th centuries, when Matteo Ricci and his confreres were establishing the first Jesuit mission in mainland China, hermetic ideas, at least when distanced from the doctrinally sensitive practices of magic and astrology, seem to have lost their subversive flavor and have entered into official digitizations of Catholic ecclesiology. Agostino Stoico's belief in the continuous preservation of philosophic truth in his book On the Perennial Philosophy of 1540 was leveraged as a counter-Reformation argument against the Restorationism inherent to many branches of Protestantism. Similarly, the Annales Ecclesiastici of the church historian Caesar Baronius made liberal recourse to Lactantius in his section on pagan prophecy, claiming that pagan prophets such as Hermes Trismegistus and the Sibyls had foretold the redemptive mission of Christ. It is no accident that what Francis Yates called the watershed moment that marked the end of the Renaissance and the beginning of the modern period, that is, the redating of the Corpus Hermeticum to late antiquity in 1614 by the French Huguenot Isaac Casaubon, took place in the context of a Protestant critique of Baronius' apologetic history of the Catholic Church. Yet, while Casaubon's attack was theologically rigorous and extremely influential, it failed to abate the popularity of Hermetic ideas, which received new fervor in the 17th century, albeit often detached from the Ficinian Corpus Hermeticum. Amongst the Jesuits, the foremost exponent of the post-Casaubon Hermeticism was Kirche, of course. His attempt to derive Chinese religion from Egypt through the genealogical transmission of the ancient theology profoundly influenced Jesuit writings in China in the second half of the 17th century. On the surface, it would seem that Jesuits active prior to the publication of Kirche's voluminous ecclesiological writings were rather unenthused about Renaissance Hermeticism, especially when compared to contemporaries such as Stelco and Baronius. Despite the depth of Jesuit pedagogy codified in the Ratio Studiorum to the Renaissance revival of classical learning, the prominence of Thomism in the Jesuit curriculum prejudiced many Jesuits in the 16th and 17th centuries against Renaissance esotericism. In 1592, Benito Pereira, a theologian who taught at the Collegio Romano, denounced the various forms of superstitious arts, including magic, astrology, and the Kabbalah, in the Adversus Fallacis Superstitiosus Artis. Pereira also disputed Stelco's contention that the ancient pagan religions could be reconciled with Judeo-Christian tradition. Most famously, in 1599, the Jesuit Martin del Rio published his vociferous attack on magic, the Disquisitione Magicarum Libri Sex. Although the controversies over magic were conceptually distinct from the ancient theology, del Rio attributes the corruption of magic to the ancient magi, such as Zoroaster and Orpheus. The Oriental peoples founded their system of magic on a dualistic cult of false gods, which had been taught to hand prior to the flood by demonically inspired giants, then passed down to the Egyptians, Chaldeans, and Persians. Hence, del Rio's critique of Ficinian magic simultaneously undermined the ancient theology and the plausibility that Oriental religions had maintained the worship of the true God. Other notable Jesuit theologians, such as Francisco Suarez, Robert Bellarmine, and Dionysius Catavius, eschewed the esoteric movement of the Renaissance for scholastic rationalism. There were, however, some Jesuit voices who sought to find space for the Hermetic tradition within this general climate of disapprobation. The most important example for the development of the Jesuit accommodation of Chinese philosophy was... It's disappeared. Okay. important example for the development of the Jesuit accommodation of Chinese philosophy was the Jesuit diplomat and encyclopedist Antonio Possevino. In the Biblioteca Selecta of 1593, Possevino sought to articulate a counter-Reformation response to the relentless rise of heterodox scholarship epitomized by bibliographies such as the Biblioteca Universalis of Conrad Gesner and Josiah Simler. In Possevino's mind, these Protestant authors threatened Catholic piety by uncritically agglomerating Catholic, heretical, rabbinical, and pagan writings without providing the necessary tools to sift out heterodox opinions. The pedagogical program outlined in the Bibliotheca Selecta is firmly within the Jesuit tradition of eclectic Thomism, but it features significant cautious overtures towards various esoteric traditions, which suggests a desire for a more expansive understanding of a canon compatible with Catholic orthodoxy. From the outset, Possevino's effusive praise for leading proponents of the ancient theology evinces his disagreement with his contemporary Pereira. Stelfel's perennial philosophy is lauded as a salubrious method for interpreting the works of pagan philosophers that is in continuity with the tradition of the Preparatio Evangelica. This concept was concretized in the eponymous apologetic treatise of Eusebius, which claimed that anticipations of Christian revelation in certain pagan texts can be regarded as providentially inspired means to prepare the Gentiles for Christianity. Even Pico's Hepatus, the Oration on Dignity of Man, and other writings, which are replete with hermetic references, are singled out as of great use for furthering our understanding of Aristotle's thought. Recent political and theological developments still necessitated circumspection in Possevino's evaluation of Pico's esoteric interests, in particular the Kabbalah. The 16th century marked another in Jewish and Catholic relations. Threatened by the rise of Protestantism and internal division, the Church intensified its persecution of the Jews by ordering the burning of the Talmud in 1553. In 1592, the year in which the Bibliotheca Selecta received its imprimatur, Clement VIII issued a bull which condemned the impious Talmud, the Kabbalah, and all other, quote, nefarious Jewish books. Possevino's position in contemporary debates about the Jews and Jewish literature is complex and extremely difficult to classify. On the one hand, the Jesuit was an outspoken opponent of discrimination against Jewish conversos in the society, arguing that Ignatius of Loyola insisted upon the absolute equality of men regardless of their ethnic origin. But the Apparatus Sacer of 1608, which was intended as a companion volume to the Bibliotheca Selecta, followed contemporary theological attitudes in its categoric repudiation of the Talmud for its purported blasphemies against Christ and the natural law. Possevino even contends that Pietro Galantino was mistaken to have defended Johann Reutlin's use of the Talmud as a means of converting the Jews. Instead, he declares his wholehearted endorsement of its burning by ecclesiastical authorities. As the Jewish Kabbalah is listed among the pernicious texts that Possevino believes to have been justly burnt, it is striking that he refuses to condemn Pico's Kabbalism outright. To be sure, in the Bibliotheca Selecta at least, he argues that the lucid intelligibility of Christian truth as evident in the Gospels and scholastic philosophy made the Kabbalah an unnecessary distraction that was more likely to be harmful than beneficial. Importantly, however, he acknowledges that there may be some truth in the writings of the Kabbalists, albeit wrapped beneath layers of errors. This crucial concession acquires great significance in the more accommodating stance towards the Kabbalah that features in the Apparatus Sacer, where the doctrinal difficulties that have engulfed Jewish mysticism in both Pico and Possevino's days are briskly passed over. Strikingly, Possevino reports that Pico had remarked in the fifth question of his Apology that the Kabbalah is not only compatible with Catholic orthodoxy, but provides a precious opportunity for Christians to wield the Jews' own weapons against them. So you can see the quote here, which I've translated. When I perused those books which had been purchased to me at great expense, I found that many things, or rather nearly all things in them, are consonant with our faith. As Jews greatly honor and revere the authority of the Kabbalists, these are weapons with which Christians can fatally wound the Jews. Pico only issued the Apology in 1489 in order to defend 13 of the 900 theses proposed for the Rome debates of 1486, which had been thwarted by Pope Innocent VIII and enemies in the Roman Curia. Although Pico was exonerated by successor Alexander VI, one would presume that a reflection on Posadino's past, on this polemical context, would have been one of the crucial calciones necessary for piety that his predecessors had perilously omitted. Besides Pico's apology, Posadino also leverages in defense of the Kabbalah the Bibliotheca Sancta Expertibus Catholicae per Ecclesiae Auctoribus Collector of 1566, which was compiled by Sixtus of Siena. As a personal acquaintance of Posadino, renowned for his knowledge on Judaism. In the Bibliotheca Sancta, Sixtus included excerpts of the Talmud which purportedly showed the daily blasphemes that the Jews uttered three times a day against the Christians and their plots to overthrow Christendom. As an inquisitor, he played a key role in burning the Talmud in Cremona, which had doggedly refused to enforce the papal ban. Despite his opposition to the Talmud and the stringent papal bans, Sixtus, like Posadino after him, believed that the Kabbalah could be legitimately used in the conversion of the Jews should sufficient distinction be made between the rightfully condemned Kabbalah passed down by the Jews and the true Kabbalah practiced by Christians. Indeed, amidst the conflagration in the Hebrew libraries of Cremona, Sixtus ensured that the books of the Kabbalah were salvaged. For Sixtus, the Kabbalah was an unbroken oral tradition received by Moses from the mouth of God in order to draw us from earthly things up to heavenly things. In the passage cited by Posadino, Sixtus compares the Kabbalah to the anagogical interpretation of Scripture, a hermeneutic which, according to Aquinas, consisted in the examination of the spiritual significance of sacred Scripture as opposed to the moral interpretation of Scripture that was a proper object of allegorical exegesis. Although Posadino discusses this comparison with reference to Sixtus, these remarks can be traced back to Pico's apology. As François Sauvé shows, there were quite a few contemporary Jesuits who circumvented this papal ban on the Kabbalah by differentiating between good and bad Kabbalah, including Nicholas Cerarius, Maximilian van der Sand, Jacques Bonfrère, and Cornelius Alapide. So this pattern of cautious critique, followed by circumspect acceptance, recurs in Posadino's account of Hermes Trismegistus. The context in which Hermes is introduced seems at first glance hostile to any positive reception of the Corpus Hermeticum. Hermes is placed within the sequence of chapters concerning suspect historical works, which are to be avoided because of their potential dangers to Christian piety. The Egyptians, like the Chaldeans, are portrayed as being steeped in superstition and idolatry. While Posadino conveys the impression that the ancient Egyptians had remnants of monotheism and an understanding of the immortality of the soul, both doctrines had been disfigured to the point of no return. The cult of the one God had been substituted with that of the sun and the moon, the idolatry of statues and apotheosized mortals. The universal wisdom of the Egyptians attributed to Hermes Trismegistus by Iamblichus in the De Mysteriis Egyptiorum is dismissed as insipientia and perfidia. Hermes' prodigious output of 36,525 books conveys no suggestion of a prolific sage, but taints the legends surrounding the Egyptian patriarch with ludicrous implausibility. Indeed, Posadino even anticipates Casaubon's theological analysis by claiming that the great majority of those books cited by Iamblichus were not written by Trismegistus, but by Greek philosophers of late antiquity. Yet, as with the Kabbalah, Posadino refuses to jettison the Hermetic tradition in its entirety, and instead presses for its reevaluation, premised upon the exclusion of those texts which, in his mind, were apocryphal. He astutely notes that the Hermetic corpus of 14 Violets translated from Greek into Latin by Marsilio Ficino in 1463 under the title Hymenda, and for the most part, the Asclepius, seem to have little in common with the magical and astrological doctrines described by Iamblichus. Proserpina's insight is not entirely groundless. Even modern philologists have expressed their perplexity at the disjuncture between the Hermetic tradition's reputation for enchantments and horoscopy and the relatively benign esoteric content of the Pimander and the Asclepius, which, except for one cryptic passage about the ensoulment of statues, and the invocation of demons and angels, are almost entirely devoid of magical content and focus instead on the cultivation of an aesthetic piety privy to a select few as a means of release from the material world. For the Jesuit Encyclopedists, Hermes' authenticity as a prophet was validated by his remarks on God, the Holy Trinity, the Incarnation, and the Last Judgment. The idolatries and superstitions attributed to Hermes by Iamblichus were nothing but a corruption, which Hermes himself had foreseen in the famous apostrophe in the Asclepius, which Hermes himself that denounces the future desecration of Egypt's religious mysteries. O Egypt, Egypt, of your religions only fables will remain, and even they will be disbelieved by your posterity. Hence, the Pimander and the Asclepius were more accurate reflections of Hermetic doctrine than the accounts of Iamblichus. Influential over Proserpina's account of Hermes' Trismegistus was Hannibal Rosselli, a Franciscan professor at the Academia Krakowska. From 1585 to 1590, Rosselli published a lengthy six-volume commentary on the Pimander and the Asclepius that would be successful enough to see a second edition in 1630. Although Rosselli was originally from Calabria, he was unsympathetic to the magical currents of Hermeticism, popular amongst many of his contemporary Italians, especially Giordano Bruno, and looked instead beyond the Alps to the French interpreter François Foix de Candale, whose edition of the Pimander was used in the preparation of his commentary. As Antoine Febvre observes, Foix Candale disparaged the passage concerning the ensoulment of statues in the Asclepius as a corruption interpolated the dialogue by its translator, traditionally identified as Apuleius of Medaurus. Similarly, Rosselli decries magic as a demonic art, which derived not from Hermes Trismegistus, but from Zoroaster. His Hermes was not only aloof from magic, but a strategic asset in the battle against all the wiles of the devil. According to Proserpina's paraphrase of Rosselli's commentaries, Hermes' primary insights were his knowledge of the Holy Trinity and his oracles infused through a divine vision. Astonishingly, Proserpina refers to an unpublished letter of Rosselli in which Augustine is summoned as an authority confirming the authenticity of Hermes' oracles. Although Augustine vacillates between apathy and antipathy towards the Hermetic tradition, in the City of God, he makes ambiguous comments which could be interpreted as acknowledgement of the historical fact of Hermes' existence and his possible relationship with Moses. Augustine's purpose in the passage was to proclaim the temple priority of Hebrew wisdom over all Gentile civilization. As Egypt made claims to wisdom of millennial antiquity, especially in the figure of Hermes Trismegistus, who had acquired particular prestige amongst certain Neoplatonic and even Christian circles, Augustine had no choice but to include Hermes in his discussion. The context surrounding the passage makes it clear that Augustine regarded Egyptian wisdom as, for the most part, an imposture. But in order to reaffirm the integrity of the biblical chronology, Augustine positions Hermes in the time of Moses. That an authority of Augustine's stature would affirm Hermes as a contemporary of the Egyptian-born Moses no doubt excited Ficino, who pointedly commences his introduction to the Pimander with a direct citation of Augustine's words. For Proserpina, the contemporaneity of Moses and Hermes is proof that Hermes had in fact received the wisdom found in the Pimander and his Asclepius from Moses himself. question that now remains to be answered is how Possevino's hermetic interests informed his proposed method for the evangelization of the Chinese, who, together with the Japanese and the other newly discovered peoples in the Far East and the New World, were collectively referred to as Indians. Before this question is attempted, however, it is necessary to examine Possevino's account of Chinese religion and philosophy, which, despite being the first official Jesuit statement on the matter, has received scarcely any academic attention. When the Bibliotheca Selecta received its imprimatur on the 16th of April 1592, the Jesuit mission in China was not yet 10 years old. Jesuit policy towards China, officially under the patronage of the Bishop of the Missions in the Indies, Alessandro Valignano, had not yet assumed the ideological cohesion of Ricci's accommodation. Possevino's primary source was not Ricci, but Ruggieri, who, while not inherently ill-disposed towards the Confucian tradition, did not believe a reconstructed primitive Confucianism could be systematically usurped as a foundational natural theology for the Christian religion. Although Ruggieri was very critical of Buddhist idolatries, outwardly, Ruggieri assumed the guise and demeanor of a Buddhist monk from the establishment of the mission in 1583 until his departure in 1588. In his Chinese poetry, Ruggieri consistently presents himself as a son who traveled to China from the west, Xizhu, through India, Tianzhu. In his Chinese catechism, the Tianzhu Shilu, Ruggieri freely uses a variety of Buddhist terms to translate Christian concepts, such as De Dao, Shen Xian, the saints. Ricci's decision to relinquish the Buddhist habit for the dress of a literati took place only 2 years after Possevino published the Bibliotheca Selecta, and 7 years after Ruggieri parted from China for Rome. The fluidity of missionary policy at the time made it very difficult for Possevino to fulfill his promise of providing a coherent method for evangelizing the Chinese. Yet, Possevino's manual already outlines in embryo some of the foundations of the scholastic approach that would enter into prominence through Ricci's writings. Programmatic for Possevino's discussion in Indians is Aquinas' Summa Contra Gentiles. For Aquinas, all intercultural engagement is premised upon shared presuppositions. Since the Jews and the heretics acknowledge the supernatural authority of the Bible, for instance, the Bible can be used to convert Jews and combat heresy. When dealing with the pagans, however, the Bible is of no avail, because its injunctive force derives primarily from the assumption of its divine authorship, which the pagans, of course, do not recognize. Hence, in such disputes, Christian apologists can only make recourse to natural reason, which, at least in theory, unites all cultures in a common humanity. But the human mind, when not informed by faith, is defective in any discourse with the divine due to its insurmountable cognitive limitations. In patristic writings, the appropriation of the Hermetic tradition and the Sibylline oracles, almost as an appendage to the prophetic text of the Old Testament, partially obviated this stumbling block. By being able to establish the authenticity of Christ's divine mission with reference to accepted pagan textual traditions. Even some works of Aquinas, the authority of the Sibylline oracles is confirmed as authentic Christological prophecies following Augustine. But for Aquinas, these extra scriptural texts never acquire the apologetic significance assumed in Lactantius's Divine Institutes. In the Summa Contra Gentiles, Aquinas proposes a rich series of arguments designed to compel assent to rationally knowable doctrines such as divine unity. But when it comes to the truth of doctrines known only by revelation, such as the divine trinity, he claims it is impossible to provide rational proofs which are sufficiently cogent to convince a pagan reader because of the cognitive limitations inherent to human reason. Probable arguments can be adduced to explain the Trinity, but they exist not for the evangelization of infidels, but for the consolation of the faithful. Indeed, for Aquinas, the employment of these inadequate arguments in apologetics would be counterproductive, as they give pagans the false impression that the foundations of the Christian faith are flimsy. Ultimately, the progression from philosophy to theology is governed by faith, with a crucial qualification that truths naturally attained by the rational faculties cannot contradict revelation. While reports from distinguished missionaries Michele Ruggeri and Alessandro Valignano constituted Posadino's primary sources for specific details on China and Japan respectively, his understanding of how the Chinese relate to other pagan peoples is principally based upon the ethnographic writings of the Jesuit New World missionary José de Acosta. The text cited in the Biblioteca Selecta is the preface to the De Promulgazione Evangelii Quod Barbaros, Sive de Procurandi Dorum Salute Libri Sex, which was published together with the De Natura Novi Ordini Libri Duo in 1589. The latter work was then translated into Spanish and formed the first two books of De Acosta's highly influential The Natural and Moral History of the Indies. De Acosta's writings naturally focused on the New World, where he resided for some 16 years before returning to Spain in 1587. But due to De Acosta's interest in comparative ethnography and the speculation of the possible Asian origin for the American indigenous peoples, they also included significant discussion on the Chinese and Japanese in relation to their respective writing systems, cultural practices, fauna, diet, and religion. Acosta's division of the Indians into three classes serves to provide empirical support for a rationalist approach to the proselytization of China, akin to that advocated by Aquinas. According to Acosta, the Indians can be distinguished by their literary culture, religious ceremonies, and governmental structures. The highest category is occupied by those civilizations which are guided by right reason and have stable government and laws, flourishing commerce, and a high level of literacy. Here are placed the Chinese, the Japanese, and, quote, the majority of the provinces of eastern India, to which I am certain Asian and European customs had once reached. Amongst these privileged Indians, the Chinese occupy a preeminent position because they exceed all other barbarian peoples with their abundance of books, with the splendor of their academies, with the authority of their laws and magistracies, and with the magnificence of their public works. Despite obvious deficiencies in the customs and laws of these peoples, Acosta advocates that any attempt of proselytization be conducted along the lines of a rational engagement, in the same vein that the apostles preached to the Greeks, Romans, and the peoples of the Middle East and Europe. Posadino's chapter on China in the Biblioteca Selecta clearly betrays some of the hallmarks of Ruggeri's less embracive approach to Chinese philosophy, his hesitancies over Chinese monotheism. Already, in Acosta's aforementioned study, it is asserted as an uncontroversial point of ethnographic comparison that the Chinese, along with the Mexicans and Peruvians, worship the one true God, and that correspondences could be drawn among this monotheistic cult, Greco-Roman philosophy, and even the Hermetic tradition. This monotheism is variously equated with the Ignoto Deo, to which St. Paul famously referred in the Acts of the Apostles, and surprisingly, the philosophy of Timaeus and Plato, in the metaphysics of Aristotle and the Asclepius of Trismegistus, as also in the poesies of Homer and Virgil. It is this latent monotheism which, in Acosta's mind, facilitated the preaching of the gospel to the Indian peoples. Ruggeri's earliest observations on Chinese religion do not support such a view. In a letter dated 12 November 1581, that Ruggeri sent from Macau to Superior General Everett McCurian, prior to Ricci's arrival in China, Ruggeri reveals that he does not regard the moral maxims taught in China as philosophy and affirms that the Chinese, despite their valiant efforts to live a morally upright life, do not have any knowledge of God. Later in the letter, Ruggeri repeats this assertion, adding that the nearest thing the Chinese have to a notion of God is the word Tian, which in his mind was synonymous with the physical heaven. This passage does not necessarily imply, as Paul Gould has suggested, that Ruggeri's interpretation of Tian was purely materialistic, nor is it correct that his stance never changed. In the Vera Breve Biennale Brero Expositio, the expanded Latin edition of Rogeri's 1584 Chinese Catechism, the Tianlu Shulu, which is epitomized in the Bibliotheca Selecta, Confucius' knowledge of God is briefly discussed. His pagan interlocutor admits that the Christian golden rule of doing unto others as you would have them do unto you finds resonance in Confucian teaching, but is amazed that he finds no correspondence with the concept of God, despite Ruggieri's insistence that such a doctrine is universally knowable. Attenuating his early categorical rejection of Chinese monotheism expressed in his 1581 letter to Mercurian, Ruggieri conjectures that Tian might have been used by Confucius to indicate the, quote, supreme governing mind of heaven and earth, but remains nonetheless uncommitted to this view. In another unpublished manuscript, the De Animi Cultu Arque Optima Disposizione ad Recipientum Evangelium, which was drafted after his return to Rome to provide material for Cosimino's Bibliotheca Selecta, Ruggieri seemingly adopts the Ricciian view that the Chinese acquire knowledge of God through the exercise of natural reason and express their monotheism with the term Shanti, or Supreme King, as Cosimino translates. He proceeds to allege that the Chinese attribute this divinity characteristics akin to the divine attributes of the scholastic tradition, such as omniscience, omnipotence, and providence. It remains true, however, that Ruggieri was notoriously inconsistent and never developed the overtures toward the Confucian tradition to the same degree as Matteo Ricci in the Tianlu Shiyi and the De Cristiani Spedizione a Pulcinas. It is interesting that Cosimino, despite reproducing almost all the principal points contained in Ruggieri's manuscript, De Animi Cultu, does not even raise the question of Chinese monotheism. It is possible, as Joseph Shi has speculated, that as the relevant passage was placed at the end of Ruggieri's manuscript, it was composed at a later date. But it's also possible that Cosimino excluded this passage because he was unconvinced by the inconsistencies in Ruggieri's position. Similarly, although Balignano requested that his missionaries employ the Italian culture as the point of reference for the Jesuits' evangelization of China, Cosimino never mentions Confucius. Unlike in later Jesuit translations of Chinese classics, such as the Sapienza Sinica of 1662 and the Confucius Synodal Philosophers of 1687, the Da She is presented merely as a book on morality without any indication of its pedagogical role in the canon of the four books. Ruggieri was plainly well aware of the importance of the four books in the formation of his writing, because he reflects upon his habit of reading the four books in one of his Chinese poems, and was responsible for their first translation into Latin. Clearly, the omission of this crucial contextual information does not stem from ignorance, but from Ruggieri's own ambivalence towards Confucius expressed in his Chinese catechism. The only doctrine distinctly within the Confucian tradition expounded in Cosimino's discussion is that of the five constant virtues, or the Wu Chang, rendered in Latin as perpetua virtutes, which along with the five moral relationships, or the Wu Lin, or mutuae virtutes, are cited in the preface to the catechism and again in De Animi Cultu. Despite Cosimino's silence on Chinese monotheism and Confucius, his selective citation of Ruggieri's materials conveys a rather elevated conception of Chinese philosophy and theology. Interestingly, Cosimino claims, following Ruggieri's De Animi Cultu, that the Chinese possess an understanding of the mind's division into two parts, intelligentsia and voluntas. I have not succeeded in locating the philosophical grounds for Ruggieri's claim, as neither Cosimino nor Ruggieri elaborate on this point. In the Ver Brevis Divinarum Verum Expositio, Ruggieri's discussion of the soul is limited to proving its immortality, and unlike in Matteo Ricci's Tianlu Shiyi, does not cite the Chinese classics in support of this claim. It would seem, however, that Ruggieri was likening the Chinese conception of the soul to that of Aquinas, who in the Questiones Disputate de Veritate collapses Augustine's distinction between intelligentsia and memoria into one power. In another manuscript composed around 1591, the Alcunia Vici del Morte Tai Cinesi, Ruggeri seemingly contradicts this claim by suggesting that these two faculties are, quote, very corrupted and damaged, and can only be restored to perfection with knowledge and love of Christ. This deprecating remark is not reflected in Prosopino's text, which, while acknowledging the need for perfection of divine grace, cites the Chinese understanding of the soul as a signal illustration of China's intellectual achievements, which lack almost nothing available to the human mind through the exercise of natural reason. Due to their unswerving desire for intrapersonal inspection and the exercise of their ingenio and industria. The premise of these remarks, though not the inference, would seem to be loosely inspired by Ruggeri, who in his 1581 letter to Mercurian similarly praised the ingenio and abilità of the Chinese, especially in the exercise of the moral virtues. Ruggeri appended to the letter a rough translation of a short book on morality to illustrate his point. As Pietro Tacchi-Venturi noted, it is impossible with our current sources to identify with absolute certainty the precise text to which Ruggeri is referring, but I believe that Lumbai is most likely correct in identifying it with the Darshe, published in the Bibliotheca Selecta. As in Ruggeri's letter, the Darshe in the Bibliotheca Selecta is described as, quote, a book on morals, and its size compared to other works, including the four books and five classics, would match Ruggeri's description of the book as being, quote, very small in comparison with the others. But whereas for Ruggeri the Darshe was primarily a text of moral instruction, for Prosopino it also exemplified the heuristics employed by the Chinese in reaching the summit of intellectual endeavor possible within the cognitive limitations of natural reason. The character Dao at the beginning of Prosopino's edition of the Darshe is translated, as in Ruggeri's original manuscript, as ratio. This highly polysemous word has a broad semantic field in Latin, ranging from reason to calculation, but here, given the overall pedagogical scope of the Bibliotheca Selecta, suggests a comparison between the method of learning outlined in the Darshe and the Jesuit Ratio Studiorum. The later Jesuit translations published in the Sapientia Sinica of 1662 and the Confucius Sinan Philosophus of 1687 rendered Dao as institutum, which, while still related to pedagogy, loses the connection with rational ordering that is integral to Prosopino's founding of Chinese morality upon methodical self-examination. Ratio appears four times in the short text and shifts from its pedagogical acceptation to the meaning of reason itself, especially in the injunction to education to be conducted, quote, according to the precepts of reason, ex rationis preceptis, and for our living to agree with reason, cum ratione consentire. The structure of the Darshe, with its simple progression of conditions and consequences, is conducive to such a reading. But Ruggeri and Prosopino make this even more explicit with the lexical and syntactical features of the Latin language. For instance, the expression zaim, meaning the translated by James Legge as, quote, to illustrate illustrious virtue, is broken up by Ruggeri into two distinct processes. First, the apprehension of the life of nature, and secondly, the execution of its dictates. In lumine naturae conoscendo et sequendo. Strategically, Prosopino truncates his text with hoc vero ut praestarens, quiusque re causas et naturas nocere suduerunt, which loosely corresponds with rendered by Legge as such extension of knowledge lay in the investigation of things. The founding of Chinese moral practice upon Go Wu, the investigation of things, was, as noted above, the pretext of Prosopino's inclusion of the Darshe. Prosopino's text essentially captures the meaning of the original, but introduces the extraneous concept of causality. While Prosopino's translation is, on the whole, impressively accurate in light of the lack of language learning resources at the time, the emphasis upon ratio, ordo, and causa would perhaps leave the European reader with a somewhat misleading impression that Chinese heuristics had much in common with the scholastic method. For Aquinas, Posidonius' claim that the Chinese possessed the fullness of knowledge available to natural reason would have implied knowledge of a transcendent God and divine attributes. But as mentioned above, Posidonius resists such an inference. Instead, Posidonius founds the vaunted natural theology of the Chinese upon a valorization of the concrete goods that can be derived from religious practice. Astonishingly, for Posidonius, the supreme expression of this natural theology is astrology. As we saw above, for Posidonius' Jesuit contemporaries such as Darío and Pereira, astrology was a pernicious discipline of demoniac inspiration. Even Posidonius' rehabilitation of Hermes Trismegistus was contingent upon the dissociation of astrological doctrines imputed to the Egyptian sage by Yamlid. Yet here, Posidonius seems to suggest that astrology, despite its inherent erroneousness, can serve an ulterior good in instilling a religious and moral sensibility and in enabling the Chinese to transcend the human and aspire to the heavenly. The scope of Chinese astrology is left deliberately vague in Posidonius' published text, but in the original manuscript, Ruggieri is much more explicit in describing the nature of Chinese astrological practice. So I just read from the bottom there. The Chinese thoroughly embrace astrology, which they practice as much as possible. They have an exact understanding of the number of stars, their difference, order, alteration, constancy, and aspects. But among the Chinese, this science should be called theology rather than astrology. They worship heaven as God, whom they call Tian. Although Posidonius, like Ruggieri before him, ultimately damns the Chinese, their damnation ensues not from the inherent sinfulness of astrology, but from their lack of faith, which alone is able to perfect the will to the acquisition of true knowledge. Posidonius and Ruggieri have a remarkably Augustinian soteriology, which denies salvation even to those who have perfected their doctrines and actions to the fullest extent possible within the limitations of unaided human efforts. The principal interest of Ruggieri and Posidonius, however, does not consist in the possibility of salvation within autochthonous pagan traditions, which would undermine the distinctive soteriological emphasis of Ruggieri's missionary practice, but rather the extent to which these traditions, in foreshadowing Christian doctrine, can ease the conceptual passage from natural theology to divine revelation. In De Animiculto and in the Bibliotheca Selecta, Ruggieri lists a series of religious, cultural, and political characteristics which in their minds demonstrate that the Chinese have been adequately prepared for the gospel. Ruggieri's language is evangelic, evoking comparison with the Eusebian Preparatio Evangelica that was the centerpiece of Stoical's perennial philosophy. The five constant virtues, for instance, are, as it were, a supreme form of preparation, maxima preparationis a Christiana religionem excipiendam, a precultivation, precultiones, and the harrowing, subactiones, of the land so that the seed of the divine word may be sown to greater effect. The humanistic flavor of this passage is reinforced by comparing the moral preparation of the Chinese to the necessity of geometric preparation required for philosophic inquiry, encapsulated by the apocryphal text that, at least according to a late Neoplatonic tradition, hung on the gates of the Platonic Academy. This portrait of rationally grounded moral purity would have been compromised by any insinuation that the Chinese people were superstitious. In Ruggieri's unpublished writings, such as his suppressed Lationes, there are numerous references to the widespread practice of idolatry. In the Impedimenti per la Conversione dei Cinesi, Ruggieri laments the immense difficulty in uprooting the, quote, infinity and diversity of the many idols placed in the public and private temples. Because of their entrenched role in familial customs, the reputation for sanctity and imperial protection. Yet, there is not a hint of these challenges in the De Animiculto and in the Bibliotheca Selecta. While acknowledging the presence of Buddhist priests with idolatrous doctrines, he or Ruggieri and Posidonius claim that both these priests and their idolatrous doctrines are held in contempt. Generally speaking, the Chinese are skeptical of superstition, but nonetheless have a religious sensibility that is willing to accept divine truth when it is properly proclaimed. In anticipation of Ricci, Ruggeri and Cosovino maintain that the Chinese are themselves conscious of the fact that these idolatries are alien to their ancient histories. Amongst the Chinese, there is another class of priests, the Luzi, which I presume is a corrupted reference to the Taoists, who, despite their empty doctrines, are fierce opponents of the Buddhist idols. Hence, for this keen sense of moral virtue, innate religious sensibility, and scorn for superstition will facilitate the evangelization of China. Cosovino does not elaborate on the theological significance of this rather purified description of Chinese religious practices for Christianity, nor explain precisely the relationship between these idolatrous sects and the intellectual culture underpinning the Dashi extract. It is not clear whether these sects are to be opposed outright, as Ricci would programmatically urge in his commentaries, or to be embraced as possible foundations for the preaching of Christianity. In the original manuscripts, however, Ruggeri gives a much more complete picture of the various idolatries espoused by Buddhism, and even details the names and attributes of some of its most important gods in the chapter on the adoration of false gods and the superstition of the Chinese. But in other parts of the manuscript, it emerges that after his return to Europe, he came under the influence of the Hermetic currents that were increasingly in vogue amongst Jesuits such as Cosovino. In an unambiguous harkening back to the Pia Philosophia tradition, Ruggeri includes a chapter on the prophecies and oracles of the Chinese. Here, Ruggeri proposes an unprecedented reinterpretation of Buddhism as a prophetic foreshadowing of Christianity that has the hallmarks attributed to the Sibylline oracles in Hermes Trismegistus by esoteric thinkers of the Renaissance. Strikingly, Ruggeri focuses on the Buddha himself, Shijia or Sakyamuni, as a figure of Christianity. Whereas in the Vera Brevis Divinarum Verum Expositio, Ruggeri disputes the Buddha's reputation for sanctity, in this manuscript, he takes his sanctity at face value and reports without comment the claim that the Buddha's doctrine was inspired by heaven. So let us read from here. The Chinese have veiled and, in my opinion, prophetic intimations of the Christian religion, and first of all, the chief object of their religious cult, Shijia, the wisest and most intelligent of beings, who they believe to have brought down from heaven the most holy law. Just as Hermes Trismegistus was said to have foretold the Trinity, Ruggeri asserts that the three different designations of the Buddha, Nanwu, which is probably derived from Nanwu, which is also pronounced Namo, Omitofe, or Omitofo, and Shijia, as figures of the three persons of the Trinity. As Wu points out, Namo, a phonetic transliteration of the Sanskrit namas, was simply an honorific placed in front of the name Omitofo and not a distinct manifestation, as Ruggeri suggests. For the first time in the Jesuit literature on China, Ruggeri also reports the apocryphal story, which dates at least to the 5th century history of the Eastern Han, the Ho Han Shu, of the arrival of Buddhism in China. According to this tradition, the Han Emperor Ming was inspired by a dream to send envoys to the western land of the Yue Zhi sometime in the mid-60s. After a period of 3 years, the envoys returned to the emperor with the sutra in 42 sections and some foreign missionaries, who, with the emperor's approval, founded the first Buddhist monastery in China, the Bai Ma Si, at Luoyang. Ruggeri reimagines the episode as an example of colossal diabolical deception. As a matter of fact, the Ming Emperor saw an angel under the guise of the golden youth who instructed him to go to the West to pursue truth. The angel intended to proclaim to the Chinese the birth of Christ, but the legates were duped by the devil to enter the land of the idols instead of Judea. As a result, the idols of Buddhism, and not the teachings of Christ, were brought to China. Although this passage reflects traditional Christian views, on the diabolical origin of idolatries, such as Buddhism, Bourget describes the initial act of revelation in the oracular medium of a dream as having come from God. In this reading of Buddhist idolatries as anticipations of Christian doctrine, Bourget is making an explicit acknowledgement of the possibility of revelation outside the Judeo-Christian canon, characteristic of the Via Philosophia tradition. In essence, Ruggieri's incipient attempt to interpolate revelation in Chinese religion constitutes the first fleeting evidence of figurism in the Jesuit China mission, with the crucial distinction that the late figurists, such as Bouvet and Clément, retained Ricci's opposition to Buddhism and sought these prophetic readings in the Confucian classics. It is unknown how much resonance Ruggieri's views received, but it's clear that he was simply echoing contemporary hermeneutic trends that appeared in Jesuit literature on other civilizations. Acosta, for instance, in his above-mentioned account on the New World, gives a full-throttle defense of the Eusebian Preparatio Evangelica and the legitimacy of ascribing value to pagan prognostications in the defense of Christianity. Citing Eusebius, Lactantius, and Prosperus, Acosta asserts that the prophecies concerning the downfall of the native kingdoms and their idolatries found in the histories and annals of the Indians should be considered authentic.
So you have the quote there.
But Ruggieri's idiosyncratic approach to Chinese religion was short-lived and actively suppressed by the Jesuit authorities. Ruggieri returned to Europe in 1588, ostensibly to organize a papal embassy. The documentary evidence reveals, however, that there was an ugly falling out between Ricci and Ruggieri, in remarks which were understandably suppressed in the official Latin translation of Ricci's Italian commentaries. Ricci alleges that Ruggieri was sent back to Europe because, being too old, he was unable to learn Chinese properly. Ricci's negative judgment of Ricci's linguistic abilities likely influenced Fabiani, who in a letter dated 23 November 1588 to the Superior General complained about Ruggieri's poor Chinese pronunciation. After his return to Italy, Ruggieri had initially planned to publish his Latin translations of the Chinese classics, which he had made as part of his pioneering efforts to craft the first curriculum for the study of Chinese language and culture. In 1596, Valignano requested in a letter to Superior General Claudio Acquaviva that Ruggieri be forbidden from carrying out the task because his written and spoken Chinese are too poor, and instead entrusted the task to Ricci. The Jesuits then moved to marginalize Ruggieri from the official histories of the mission in favor of Ricci. In some exemplary remarks inscribed on the front page of Ruggieri's Relaciones, an anonymous scribe wrote, "Non è da fidarsi ne punto, che è falso del tre quarti delle ordinazioni." So basically, he's not to be trusted at all. It would seem that from a very early stage, the Jesuit superiors had decided that Ruggieri was not only inept at Chinese and mistaken in his missionary approach, but also a liar who misrepresented China to Europe. While Ricci owes much to Ruggieri's pioneering efforts, a deep chasm separated the missionary methods, encapsulated by Ricci's decision in 1595 to lay down the Buddhist garments worn by the two missionaries since their initial foray into China, and don the garments of the Chinese mandarin. Ricci's disagreement with Ruggieri was not limited to the choice of religious and intellectual traditions, but struck at their hearts of their respective understanding of how these traditions are to be related and accommodated to Christianity. Ruggieri's incipient forays into a vigorous reading of Chinese religion were systematically and comprehensively rejected by Ricci. In his Italian commentaries, Ricci too relates that the Buddhists seem to have knowledge of the Christian Trinity because they took because they, quote, speak of a sort of trinity of three gods who come to form a single entity. Later, however, he reveals that he does not regard these trinities that can be found in Buddhism and Taoism as divinely inspired, but as evidence that, quote, the original parent of falsehood, the father of lies, has not yet put aside his ambitious desire of divine similitude. The anecdote about the Emperor Ming and the mistaken introduction of Buddhism into China is also alluded to in Ricci's commentaries and in the Tengu Shi. In both texts, however, Ricci empties the episode of its oracular significance. In the commentaries, it is related that Chinese history mentioned a certain Chinese king who was inspired by a dream to send legates to bring Buddhism back to China. It is also reported that the king's dream coincided with the preaching of St. Bartholomew and St. Thomas in India, but Ricci does not identify the object of the king's dream with the gospel. Given the proximity of India and China, Ricci infers that the Chinese must have heard of the fame of the Holy Gospel being preached in India, and thus sent legates to bring the doctrine back to China. The return of Buddhism instead of Christianity was either a result of error or malevolence. The account in the Tengu Shi is substantially the same. The Ming emperor heard when about the gospel. In both cases, there was no dreaming of Jesus, nor any role of a divinely sent angel in the delivery of information, nor a devil involved in the deception of envoys. It was a natural process of transmission through entirely human means made possible by geographical considerations. It would seem, therefore, that Ricci wanted to avoid any reliance on supernatural forces in accommodating China's intellectual and religious patrimony to Christianity. He proposed instead a rational engagement of complementary natural theologies that was far stricter in adherence to the method outlined by Aquinas in the Summa Contra Gentiles. The Pia Philosophia and the other features of the European Hermetic tradition that found voice in the writings of Cosimino, Ruggeri, and other Jesuits such as Acosta undermined this project as they introduced elements which could not be reduced to reason. Their effectiveness was predicated upon the mutual acceptance of textual authority, which the Chinese, of course, did not share. The spectre of Ruggeri's fledgling figurism was never extinguished, and soon after Ricci's death, oracles, portents, and typology gradually creeped back into the Jesuits' attempts to find authoritative sanction of Christianity in the testimony of Chinese history. Distinguished intellectuals from the Society of Jesus, at least from the late 16th century onwards, exhibited leanings towards Hermeticism, the Sibylline oracles, and the Kabbalah, and had even begun to apply these traditions in the decoding of peoples in the New World and the Far East. That these buds failed to bloom at the beginning of the China mission was but the result of Ricci's decisive reorientation of Jesuit accommodationism towards a scholastic approach to interreligious dialogue. Thank you.